Next. Hey, Peter. Hey, good to see you. Yeah. Well, welcome.
And you're listening to George Quasha interview many different artists, mostly from the Hudson Valley today, on his Art is Speaking Portraits project. And it looks like Peter Wetzler is up next.
Yes, indeed.
It's quite a marathon, huh, George?
Well, it's a minor marathon. I've had some bigger ones, actually. But not on the radio. The radio is a new venue for me in this respect, live situation. Usually I allow the thing to be kind of open-ended. I mean, under normal circumstances, I'm sure I would have talked to Tony for at least an hour.
Yeah, and then you edit it out. Like, I was just looking on the website at some of the pieces there.
Oh, yeah, edit it down to the...
Yeah,
just the essence.
The kernels.
Yeah, the kernels.
But on radio, we get to be stupid and unedited.
Yeah,
and
exactly. But then we will have an edited version, which I will smarten you up, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I will sharpen your presentation.
Make me sound much more intelligent.
Right, actually. Yeah. I'll find those bits that really work. So, just for the video, say your name.
Peter Wetzler.
Okay, great. And since our audience probably knows what you do, because you're one of those active Hudson Valley folk who keep showing up in so many different places, tell those who don't know what you do.
I just had to do a double take, because for the last 25 years, my automatic answer is I write music for film and television.
Oh.
And... I'm transitioning, so I have to. What do I say now? Because I've just launched a solo piano, relaunched my solo piano career. So I'm doing a kind of improvisatory solo piano gig right now. And in fact, I'm playing in Woodstock next Saturday night at the Kleinert, solo piano concert. And and I have a radio show that is once a month here on WGXC called
You're an insider. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Called Sound Forms Conversations with Composers.
Oh.
And so I invite composers to my studio and we talk shop.
Oh.
And so the listener gets to be a fly on a wall in a conversation between composers. And I have them play music that they're working on or things that have inspired them, things they're interested in. And it's a really wonderful document. I've gotten so much out of it. I know the listeners, both of you, have gotten a bunch out of it too.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And do you think of yourself as a composer?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do.
Okay. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take we can talk for a second. I just have to change the tape, because otherwise you're going to be saying something really profound and I'm going to have to stop you and change the tape.
I'm admiring the camera. It's a great camera.
While George changes the tape, Peter, do you have a guest lined up for this month's show we can plug?
That's a good question, Tom, and a very loaded one, because I had planned to have Laurie Spiegel, who's a pioneer of electronic music and just an amazing speaker about music and technology. She wants me to wait until September. So I was thinking of, and I have this concert next week, so I was thinking of interviewing myself next week. So I may have to do a last minute interview with Peter Wetzler.
Is that nepotism?
Yes, absolutely. In its crudest form.
If he's available, too, I guess.
Yes, yeah, I have to see if he's available.
Oh, yeah. One other thing here.
But Laurie Spiegel, I'm very excited about interviewing. I interviewed her last time for Ear Magazine back in 1970-something. 79 or something like that. And she has said so many extraordinary things. She talked about the computer being the ultimate folk instrument. She's the first person that looked at the computer or talked about the computer that way. That she saw that computer music is ultimately the reinvention of folk music. Because if you think about taking digital music in the form of digital bits and bringing it into your computer and doing something with it and then spitting it back out, it's the same thing as what folk music is about. It's just sharing music and making it your own and bringing it on to another form. I've always been a musician. I was a child prodigy.
You were making music in the womb already?
Probably. definitely was a classically trained pianist. Uh-huh. My chameleon died when I was 7 years old, mm. and I wrote funeral marches for it. Mm. And then my parents and everyone said, "Oh, he's writing music. We have to go get him trained." So my piano teacher's husband taught theory at Yale, so I learned to dissect music and finally be, you know, was able to throw that out the window many years later and actually write music.
Wow, great. So now you're back to being an individual performer yourself, right?
Yes, and it actually is composition too, because it's uh-huh. improvisation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started out composing, writing music for choreographers. Mm. I was studying with Milton Babbitt at the time. Wow. And
do you know Ben Boritz?
Well, I was supposed to study with him.
Yeah,
my last semester, when I dropped out, I had been assigned. I'd had Milton as my composition mm-hmm. teacher, and I was supposed to switch to Ben Boritz and do my senior thesis with him. And I was writing music for choreographers, and I just thought, I think I want to do this, writing music for choreographers. I don't really want to finish college. I'm not getting what I want.
I see, yeah. Uh-huh.
So I got really interested in the relationship between movement and music, and particularly in Balinese. I got really inspired by Balinese music and Balinese dance and South Indian music and dance, where the music and the dance are both completely autonomous art forms. They stand by themselves, and yet together they form this extraordinary third voice of relationship that's just so profound, and that the counterpoint between music and dance and movement is really extraordinary. So I got interested in that, and I was writing music for choreographers, part of the downtown new music scene, you know, postmodern choreographers, Bill T. Jones and Susan Marshall and David Dorfman and all those folks. And I used to play music for dance classes. I played at Merce Cunningham Studio and NYU and Lofts in Soho and Juilliard. And I taught a music for dance course down there. And so I was really interested in music and movement and the relationship between sound and movement. And then I met Julie in Toronto, and she came down and visited me. Julie's a accomplished painter, and from a family of, her father is a well-known sculptor painter in Toronto. So she came down to New York and watched me working with a choreographer. I was doing like a 20-minute dance piece, and I was getting paid $100 or $50 or something like that for a 20-minute piece. And she said, "How are we ever going to have a family if you're working for the lowest paid artist on the totem pole?" And I said, "Well, I could just as easily be doing film, TV. I like movement, the relationship between sound and movement." So I followed Julie back to Toronto. I invited, there's a place called the Music Gallery, which is like the kitchen of Toronto. I did a concert there, and I invited all these film producers and got lucky and got a feature film from that and switched into film and television, which I've been doing for the last 25 years. Oh. Did that answer your question? I kind of rolled all over the place.
Did I have a question?
I don't know. You asked me something. What was I
doing? Yeah, it was something back there, but anyway, moving forward here.
Yes.
Just let me attach to the past. Music. Talk to me about music. What is it?
Music. What is music? Okay. Wow. I love that question.
Good.
Because the Greeks, you know, the Greeks said that music was the... I completely understand this. When I think about music apart from the other arts, the Greeks used to say that music was the link between heaven and earth. Mm. And there's something in that. And there's something total... Like, other... The other arts, you know, there's all kinds of cerebral, theoretical understanding of what goes into writing and what goes into visual field when you're painting, but there is something totally mysterious and mystical about music that, you know, I think it's beyond what we can talk about, and it's what calls me to composing. I'm particularly interested in harmony and in the harmonic motion, and so when I sit at the piano, like in this new series that I'm doing, I'm just like open to and communing with the mystery of harmonic relationship. This is it's such a rich thing. It just calls me, and it's called composers all throughout history to just explore this mysterious world. And you know, scientists are now beginning to understand the healing power of music and quantify it. And one of the cool things I discovered was when I was first doing music for television, I was at one of the first all-digital post-production facilities, and there was a guy from MIT who had been hired to babysit the first digital two-track recorder, Peter Ruse, and it was called CompuSonics, and the guy who invented this two-track recorder, Stotner was his name, had also invented an algorithm, a lossless audio algorithm. Mm. So basically, in those days, the biggest hard drive was 640 megabytes. Mm-hmm. Megabytes, not even, like, you know, that was the biggest drive. So being able to store audio on a drive was so expensive that this guy had this lossless, in other words, you could, like an MP3 will squash an audio file into 1/10 the space. Yeah. Well, this thing did that, but without losing any, an MP3 will lose fidelity, but this thing did it without fidelity. Wow. And so anyhow, this guy was working with me, and he had, for his project at MIT, he'd done a visualization, a 3D representation of a fast Fourier transform, an FFT, which was like a snapshot of a sound wave in time, and a 3D real-time one. So I saw my first representation of music in three dimensions in this sound wave kind of thing. Mm. That, and so you watch the change. This was an Indian flute playing a raga, and then he had a Robert Fripp guitar solo, and I watched this thing, and it sent chills down my spine, because it was the first time that modern technology was able to now explain this extraordinary relationship between sound and movement. So I've kind of gone all over the place.
No, that's good. That's good. A good voyage. Yeah. So you're describing what music is, almost in a technical sense of, right?
Yeah. Well, and also in a sort of a spiritual that it's this mystical, unknowable thing. I mean, we have definitions like music is humanly organized sound. I remember learning that in Ethnomusicology 101 or something like that.
Right.
Music is humanly organized sound. Well, that's one definition.
Well, that's fallen by the wayside because, I mean, that is to say, at least from an anthropological point of view or from a biological point of view, I mean, there are plenty of animals that are organizing sound and doing something that sounds very like music. The minor bird of India, for instance, has non-repeating, on-the-spot, spontaneously invented songs.
Improvisations.
Call it improvisation, call it composition in the moment, you know, but they're organized. They're at least as organized as anything a human being can do. As a matter of fact, there's a problem calling it improvisation because it's so well organized. You know, they occasionally repeat, but not very often. And dolphins organize sound, whales organize sounds. It's been analyzed to the point of knowing that it's quite coherent and intelligently constructed.
Yeah.
In some way. So we'll drop the human there, at least on that one. At least if we're going to put it next to the organized.
Right. Organized sound. Right.
But then what about non-organized sound?
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
John Cage had a lot of fun with non-organized sound. Yeah. He didn't touch the sound. He just listened to it.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, it's funny that you asked that. Because I find Cage's, the whole chance thing of Cage, this is not a popular viewpoint, but I find it a little bit of a cop-out, that because it kind of does not address the extraordinary relationship between sound and the other mediums that it's working with. Like the way he worked with John Cage and the chants, you know, you know, to me, there is an extraordinary relationship between movement and music.
Yeah.
So if you do chants with it, okay, that's okay, but you're saying, you know, you're making a statement and you're copping out from actually taking the risk of exploring that relationship.
That's, well, except that John Cage showed us what kind of music he could organize on his own. I mean,
which is amazing.
The percussion music of the 40s is incredible. Nobody's quite done what he did in that respect, at least in terms of writing it.
And that's actually kind of like Schoenberg in a way, because like people talk about the 12-tone system, and I think if Schoenberg had lived on, he would have just, I mean, in fact, didn't he? I mean, didn't he throw it away? It was kind of like he was trying something out, and he probably would have said, okay, let's try something else now.
Maybe
John would have gone back to writing minimalist music. Who knows?
But one of the, you know, there's a new biography of Cage out, and if you've seen it yet, Kay Larson's book, Where the Heart Beats, which is an amazing book. I just reviewed it, actually. And
It's not Station Hill Press?
No. It's Penguin. Penguin's big time. It's been just got reviewed in the Times very positively. It's had a number of reviews already. I reviewed it for PHA. And the one of the interesting things I discovered in that, though I knew Cage personally, and I published a book of his, and I, you know, over many, many years I knew him from the late 60s, actually. Mm. I didn't know that he was 23 years old when he discovered Luigi Russolo's The Art of Noise, which is the futurist music. But the aesthetic of that book was essentially listen to the sounds that are there. And let's make music out of the sounds that are coming at us in the modern society. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't talking about chance operations, although chance operations came up frequently in Dada and futurist contexts to some extent. But then he discovered that before he studied with Schoenberg. Mm. And that's an incredible thing, because I always had it that he discovered, because he's the first one who told me to, well, not the first one, but he told me to read Russolo very early. But he had discovered that so early. I thought he had studied with Schoenberg and then got liberated from music, that kind of music, by this reading of whatever, you know. But it was actually the discovery of the I Ching, not Russolo, that pushed him into using actual chance operations. But it was in his case, the reason I think it's not necessarily a cop-out is that he designed the system so particularly. And if he didn't get the results that he wanted or that interested him, he would scrap the system and redesign the system.
No, so, I don't think it was a cop-out for him.
I don't use chance operations either, but I'm not a defender of chance operations, but two great artists have, in my opinion, arisen out of that method. One of them was Cage, the other was the poet Jackson McClough. And Jackson wrote both kinds of poetry, many kinds of poetry, because he studied with Cage at the New School, and he started using the I Ching and chance operations, and he produced a number of incredibly interesting works. But that had the effect of instructing his mind so profoundly that when he actually wrote poetry later on, which I published one of those books of the work that he wrote at that point, which was he could write that stuff from his own sensibility, with the same degree of openness that you got in chance operations. So there's something to be explored here. There's something to be understood that doesn't necessarily come up immediately in the question, is chance operations an authentic method of music composition or not? Yeah. Not to argue with you, but just to sort of irresistibly point that out because of the richness of what they did produce.
Yeah.
See? But tell me more about what music is, because it seems to me that how do you do it? What do you do when you make music?
What do I do when I make music? That's a really good question, because I kind of feel like I dissected music so thoroughly in theory. We studied Schenker analysis, which like reduces all of Western music to, like a little neighbor motion of two. Sorry, did I just, excuse me, it's radio audience. I just bumped you. So I kind of felt like, I just got to let go. So I went from dissecting music really thoroughly. And, when I was at Princeton, we spent a month on a Mozart piano, on two measures of a Mozart piano sonata. And we would look at the relationships that Mozart made from the first measure to the next measure, and how he brought, basically made the sonata out of those two measures and the relationships that he formed in those two measures. And the end result for me of that was like, I would, compose a measure, and then the second measure, I would stop. I was like, oh, well, Mozart could, well, what should I do? So I kind of felt I dissected music so that it kind of killed my whole idea of what I could do as a composer. So I spent years just improvising, just like letting go, and I was working in dance, so it was really, really good because, you know, a choreographer would say, 1, 2, 3, 4, go. And I would have to, you know, something would have to come out. So I would, like, push myself into not thinking and just improvising. And then years later, as I'd been doing that for a number of years, I started composing. I would I would start with the improvisation, like the impulse to create. And part of me feels like I want to keep, because I dissected it so thoroughly, I don't want to know what it is that I'm doing.
Yeah.
I want to just keep the mystery and the magic.
And I understand.
So so I can't, so some of the stuff I can't answer because I really don't know, and I almost don't want to know. I mean, some of me wants to know, and some of me, you know, and I know that I learn something every time I hear somebody else doing something that is exploring, like the books. I've been playing the books on my radio show lately. Do you know them? Do you know those guys?
No.
They're, Nick Zamudo, I know, is up in the area. I think he's in Kamoka. I mean, in Massmoka, up by there. They're a group that just uses, it's like a collageous kind of electronic music. And one of the things that they incorporate in their sound is sounds, distorted sounds, the kinds of sounds that when I'm recording, when you get into the red in digital, the moment you get into the red, it distorts. It's just like you throw it away.
Yeah.
Well, they don't throw it away. They make that part of their thing. But, so it makes me re-examine what I've ignored in the past. Are we past my 20 minutes?
No, it's all right. It's okay. We're a little flexible here.
Okay.
That's the beginning of a big discussion that we have to have another time.
Okay.
Because the use of what goes into the noise zone. Of course, Russolo was one version of that, one view of that. But there are a lot of other views of how you use what you would normally edit out.
Yes.
It is actually now foregrounded.
Yeah.
And that has a lot of possibilities because that is related to Cage. That is to say, how do you hear what you normally don't want to hear?
Yeah.
Or by the very notion of music, exclude. And you're confirming one Cage position, which is that your over-education in the analytical mode dulls the compositional impulse in a certain respect.
Yeah.
And that you're looking for ways out of that. His way out of that was to say, I just want to create methods of bringing into the foreground what it is I'm now learning to hear that's incredible in the sounds that are already there.
You know? Well, that goes me. I mean, I have to respond to that because that really gets to the core of what really lights me up, which is harmony, the pursuit of harmonic motion.
Yeah.
There's something extraordinary about harmonic motion.
Yeah.
And if you think about the late Viennese school where Schoenberg came out of, you know, in that time of the late Viennese school, the triad had been stretched. You had suspensions upon suspensions upon suspensions. Mm. And composers writing then felt like, well, you know, we've exhausted the tonal system. We've got to a place where you have classical music where the tonal system is just totally working. It's, you know, and then you have the Romantic period where it's stretched, and then the late Romantics, they've stretched it to the point where Schoenberg felt like, I got to start a new, cut the umbilical cords, try some new system, and he tried the 12-tone system.
Well, that's the dynamic of art in many different domains, which is it goes so far in a certain direction that you just have to sort of pull it back. You have to cut it. You have to create something that interferes with it very, very, very dramatically, and then see where the pieces fall into that. Yeah, right.
And then harmonically, there's something where we're totally anchored to these relationships of 2-to-1 and 3-to-2.
Yeah.
And there's something about the harmonic system that is just so human. It feels very organic. So, I think we're always brought back to harmony and then exploring it and stretching it in new ways. And, I think about these certain changes that Philip Glass did.
Yeah.
You know, where he would go from A minor to A flat major, which in traditional harmony, you know, you had to go through a bunch of circle of fifths to get from A minor to make it, you know, palatable for the ear. Mm-hmm. Well, when Philip Glass was first doing this change, your ear kind of went, "What's that all about?" Mm-hmm. You know, and now it's commonplace. It's in our mm-hmm. DNA. We've all got it now, and it's like, okay, well, that's a logical change. Yeah. So when I'm playing now, when I'm exploring harmony, I'm exploring like, I'm listening to the voice that says, "You can't go there," and then going there,
yeah,
and then
see what happens.
And say, "Yeah, let's go, let's hang out there."
See what's happening.
You know, so it's really been fun.
Yeah, we're exploring a lot of that. You know, John Molyneux, your friend and my friend, a great, wonderful composer and musician. He and David Arnor and I are performing together now.
He's telling me about it. Yeah,
we're playing. We're going to be playing in New York at White Box on the 31st of this month, and it's really interesting to see what happens when you get different people together who have done that a lot, on their own, and then when you're doing it together, it just takes off. It's like they'll be afraid of going anywhere anymore. Yeah. They've been down that path so many times that they, you know, it's really, really, really. It was great. Just spontaneous happening right away. Yeah,
wonderful.
So great. Well, thank you,
Peter.
You,
George.
This could go on and on. I can see that.
Yeah.